You're listening to Midori House, which was first broadcast on the 11th of September 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One at Monocle 24 in London. I'm Ted Kravitz. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as two journalists are released from jail in Ethiopia, we examine if this marks a turning point in the East African state's diplomatic position. The US faces a diplomatic headache of its own, as newly released files show they hushed up evidence that Russia, rather than Nazi Germany, was responsible for the Polish Katyn massacre. And we hear from American author and filmmaker Sebastian Junger, who tells us how he's trying to make the daily life of war-bound journalists a little bit safer.
I don't think I know a single freelance journalist, and almost everyone on the front line is freelance. I don't think I know a single one who knows anything about battlefield medicine.
Plus the latest from the airlines buying and selling at the Berlin Air Show, and how Swiss conservationists are trying to preserve the historic spectacle of cow fighting. All that, as well as news and some super music too, all to come in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House. But with the time at 18.01 here in London, it's time for the latest world news with Jonathan Wheatley.
The United States Vice President Joe Biden has drawn on his own personal tragedy as he spoke to the families of the victims at a memorial service in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, the site where United Airlines Flight 93 crashed after having been hijacked on September 11, 2001. It was one of several memorial ceremonies today to mark the 11th anniversary of the attacks, which killed nearly 3,000 people. Biden's first wife and a daughter were killed in an automobile accident back in 1972.
For no matter how many anniversaries you experience, for at least an instant, the terror of that moment returns, the lingering echo of that phone call, that sense of total disbelief that envelops you, where you feel like you're being sucked into a black hole in the middle of your chest. My hope for you all is that as every year passes, the depth of your pain recedes, and you find comfort, as I have, genuine comfort in recalling his smile, her laugh, their touch.
At least 23 workers have been burnt to death when a fire broke out in a Pakistani shoe factory in the eastern city of Lahore. People living in the neighbourhood rushed to help rescue workers trapped inside the factory. The expelled ANC Youth League president Julius Malema has today called for a national strike at all South African mines until the leadership of the National Union of Mine Workers steps down. Malema was addressing a packed stadium at a gold mine in Carletonville, where 15,000 workers have downed tools demanding salary hikes.
There must be a national strike in all the mines, demanding that Frans Baleni and the NUM leadership must step down with immediate effect.
The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has said today that the international mediator Lakhdar Brahimi will meet the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad during a visit to Syria. Ban said all sides were responsible for ending the violence.
First and foremost, the violence must stop by both sides. Then those countries who may have influence over two parties should exercise and should be united their influence. Thirdly, they should immediately begin the political dialogue to have a political resolution reflecting the genuine aspiration of the Syrian people. That's the way which we are now moving forward.
The World Bank President Jim Yong Kim has said the organisation stands ready to help debt-stricken Greece after meeting with the German Minister of Economic Cooperation and Development.
The point that I want to make is that we are a bank for the entire world. We are the World Bank. And we believe that our staff have expertise in times of crisis in places that will allow us to be helpful in countries like Greece. But we're also an organization that is run by its member countries, and we only can intervene if we're asked to intervene. We stand ready to help any country that might benefit from our expertise.
And finally, a typewriter owned by A Clockwork Orange author Anthony Burgess goes on display at the John Rylands Library in Manchester as part of an exhibition of rare books, photographs, manuscripts and film props marking the 50th anniversary of the classic and controversial novel. The book was an underground hit but went on to reach a global audience in Stanley Kubrick's 1971 film. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much, and you've kindly provided me with a picture of the famous typewriter. And nice to see that it's actually on show and not just being sold by somebody who's actually come into its possession.
Yes, absolutely. They're not making a quick buck on it. They're actually showing you the actual typewriter where he wrote all his books. Fantastic.
An interesting sort of mint green keys as well.
Yes. Yes.
That's fascinating. OK, thank you very much. 6 minutes past the hour exactly, and Jonathan will be back in about 24 minutes with the latest headlines. You're listening to Midori House.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljati, Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
First on Midori House to Ethiopia, where the release of two Swedish journalists is being seen as a milestone in press freedoms in that East African state. Reporter Martin Shibby and photographer Johan Persson were first arrested in July 2011 after entering the country from neighbouring Somalia with fighters from the Ugandan National Liberation Front rebel group. The pair had been sentenced to 11 years in prison but were pardoned by the late Prime Minister Meles Zerwani before his death last month. Well, joining us from Stockholm, Monocle's correspondent Elna Andersson. Good afternoon, Elna.
Hello, hi.
Hi there. First question really is, do we know where Persson and Shibby are? Would they not believed to be back in Sweden just yet?
What I've heard is that we don't really know where they are right now, and there hasn't been any any proper contact yet. That's at least the latest that I've heard.
Yeah, and there's going to be, according to Persson's father, Johan Persson's father, there's going to be a press conference at Stockholm's Arlanda Airport in a couple of days. But what's been the coverage of the case over the last year and a half since their imprisonment?
There's been huge coverage. It's gotten a lot of attention here in Sweden. And of course, because these these journalists were there on a proper mission to do what journalists do, and then were imprisoned, and the Sweden press freedom is really important in Sweden, of course. And then what the coverage has been about what the government is doing to get them free, basically.
Well, that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because Sweden's foreign minister, actually attended Prime Minister Zanawi's funeral. How much do we think this kind of diplomatic gesture had to do with their release?
Well, the comments have been that its diplomacy has been really important, and it's been a sensitive case where Swedish politicians have been, on one hand, trying to show respect for Ethiopia and Ethiopian laws, etc., but also to get the guys free. And it's definitely been important.
An interesting balance, as you say, because presumably Sweden has tried the diplomatic route, but then has had to get fairly hardline because, as you say, they weren't doing. They were there and through the proper processes.
Yeah, and it's been a long process, and it hasn't been sure at all that they would be released. But yeah, just today the Prime Minister Fredrik Reinfeldt talked about the process, and also that it was very important that after the initial sentencing, they applied for this pardoning sort of came out with an apology. That was the crucial step that they took.
And what's the ceremonial importance of the journalists being freed today? It's Ethiopian New Year, isn't it? September the 11th.
As I understand, that's the day traditionally when they make these kinds of decisions. But on the other hand, the comments here were that it's not sure that the Ethiopian government is gonna sort of get good press at the home country for this, but it's more an international act to for the international community to show that we can, you know, that we do care about press freedom and so on.
Indeed, yes, a sign perhaps from the new president on his views towards press freedoms and diplomacy. Is that how it's being seen in Sweden?
Exactly. Yeah, but on the other hand, people are pointing out that we shouldn't forget all the other journalists who are still jailed there, even though this has been a high-profile case. But we shouldn't forget everyone else that, you know, it's still not a model country, of course, for press freedom.
And just finally, explain what Shibien person were doing in the area in the first place.
As I understand it, they were trying to shed some light on this area in Ethiopia, which is completely closed, and we don't get any news from there. And that's why they were cooperating with this rebel group. But of course, it didn't work, and still today we don't know much about what's going on in there.
Yeah, indeed, because in that region, as you say, in Ogaden, there was the activities of a petroleum, an oil company affiliated with London Petroleum, a Swedish firm.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's of course also been a case where Carl Bildt, the Swedish foreign minister, has been involved in, and so it's been through his connections to Lundin Oil. So it's been a very complicated case here. But today, Carl Bildt and the Swedish ambassador in Ethiopia are getting lots of good mentionings for how they've been handling this case.
Okay, so a success for Swedish diplomacy there. Well, thank you for the details on that. That's Elna Andersson, Monocle's Stockholm correspondent. Coming up next on Midori House, how newly released documents on the 1940 Katyn massacre could prove embarrassing for US-Polish relations.
On Wednesday and Thursday this week, Monocle 24 heads to Helsinki. We'll be sitting down with the tastemakers behind the current world design capital in a city known for its design and architecture, with the reputation of good quality of life, efficiency and high tech. It's not just vodka, Santa Claus and reindeer, you see. That's Midori House on Wednesday and Thursday this week, right here on Monocle 24. Kippis ja kuulemiin.
Bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival. Galleries. Bears.
You are cordially invited to tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
In the latest edition, we'll get a uniquely amusing digest of the recently run Democratic and Republican conventions from US comedian Rich Fulcher, and we'll shoot the breeze with the director and executive producers of a pretty incendiary film about LCD Sound System's final gig.
We weren't looking to definitively answer any of the questions that were being asked, because there isn't one reason why the band ended. We were more looking to make a film that in some way conveyed how it felt to be there that night.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House, live from Studio One with me, Ted Kravitz. Now, this week's declassification of US documents on the 1940 Katyn massacre has been acutely embarrassing for Washington, D.C., even over 70 years after the event itself. The files appear to confirm that the Americans knew that Stalin bore responsibility for the massacre of some 22,000 Polish military and civilians in and around the Katyn Forest, despite Soviet claims that Nazi forces had killed the Poles. Furthermore, it seems that President Roosevelt hushed up proof of the murders so as not to upset the Russian premier. Well, Monocle's contributor in Warsaw is Gulliver Cragg. Hi, Gulliver.
Hi.
Now, what's new in these documents, as far as you're aware?
Well, actually,
there's no really major revelations. There are about 1,000 pages that have been kept secret up until now, but they don't change the story that Polish historians and the Polish public generally have pretty much known for some time now, which is that the Americans knew as early as 1943 that the Soviets were responsible for killing these 22,000 Polish officers, but they kept quiet about it because the Soviet propaganda line was, of course, that the Germans had committed the murders and the Americans didn't want to rock the boat while the war was still going on. But these documents do absolutely confirm this thesis, and they reveal some details about exactly how the Americans came to know. There's information about coded telegrams that were sent to American intelligence by two American prisoners of war, Donald Stewart and John Van Vliet. They'd been taken by the Nazis to see the exhumed graves, the Nazis wanting to prove that it was the Soviets. The Donald Stewart and John Van Vliet, it comes out of these documents that they absolutely didn't want to believe the Nazis. They hated the Nazis who'd taken them prisoner, but the evidence was so strong that the crimes had been committed in 1940 when the Germans hadn't got to that territory yet. And apparently the fact that they sent these coded telegrams means that President Roosevelt himself almost definitely knew in 1943 that it was the Soviets and not the Germans who committed the crime.
Indeed. So how is the significance of these declassified papers in the US being seen in Poland?
I mean, it comes to something of an official admission of a cover-up. So now there can be calls, and they are coming from some polls, that there should be an official apology to Poland from the U.S. about this. Some polls are also wondering if it's going to help Poland put pressure on the Russians to uncover the whole truth, because the Russians have still got a large number of secret documents which families of the victims in Poland have been struggling for years to get hold of. They want to know the details of how exactly it happened and how their relatives exactly were killed. Now, although the US and Britain threw out cases trying to implicate the Germans for Katyn at the Nuremberg trials, and in 1951 the Madden Committee in the US concluded the Soviets were responsible. Basically, the US didn't say unequivocally that it knew this until after the Soviet Union fell in 1992, and this now is that this much more of an official admission that they knew.
Yeah, and I guess as we've been talking about diplomacy already in the programme, the US is bound to face some kind of questions from now on, from as you say, either relations or the press itself, or even the Polish or the government.
Certainly to a certain extent, but at the same time, there are some quite good justifications for why the Americans did what they did. You know, you can speculate, of course, about the impact that it might have had on the Cold War if the Americans had said at the time that the Soviets were responsible for this massacre and on Russia's subsequent domination of communist Poland. But I don't think very many historians think that it could have changed that much. And a lot of people, in Poland included, do understand the problem the Americans had. If they had come out and blamed Stalin for this heinous crime, then they had a genuine fear that Stalin could then make peace with Hitler, who could then focus all his energies on the Western Front and possibly yet win the war. So in terms of the military strategic reason why they didn't reveal this truth at the time, there's quite a good justification for that. What there's a lot less justification for is that in the half century when Poland was under Russian domination and forced to live in this lie with the communist Polish government going along with the lie that the Germans were responsible for Katyn, that the Americans even then didn't say anything, and that they didn't say anything until after the Soviet Union fell in 1992. That's a lot more hard to swallow.
So do you think anybody expecting or perhaps wanting an apology from the US will be waiting a long time?
I don't know. No, I don't know why now that it's so much time has passed. I think it's possible that an apology could be coming from the US, but I don't know that it will have really that much impact. Broadly, Polish-US relations are reasonably good, so I'm not sure that this can rock the boat too much. And I think that the Poles have already sort of swallowed a lot of their unhappiness and disgust about this.
Indeed, because it was widely known all the time, you know, for the last 70 years, as you've already said. In that case, and given how the Katyn massacres remain such a sensitive topic in Poland, what's been the reaction over the last couple of days there?
Well, For the polls, Tatin is basically an attempted genocide. They see it as having been a strategy of killing the educated elite so that the country would be pliable to invasion and domination by Russia, and that this was part of a plan that Stalin had right at the beginning of the war. So it's an extremely sensitive issue, and it was, of course, brought back to the forefront of the national consciousness 2 years ago when President Lech Kaczynski and 95 others were killed in a plane crash on their way traveling to Katyn. So it's extremely sensitive. And Lech Kaczynski's surviving twin brother, Jarosław Kaczynski, who now leads the main opposition party here in Poland, normally jumps on anything related to Katyn or to the plane crash as an opportunity to again say that Poland is a victim of some kind of international conspiracy and that Donald Tusk's government is failing to defend the country. And the interesting thing is that he hasn't this time. And I guess that's partly because he is currently realizing that perhaps he's gone a bit too far with that and is trying to show that he also has something to say about the economy, and his whole communication strategy this autumn is talking about the economy and turning away a little bit from these kinds of historical international questions. But it's also perhaps because he himself has always been reasonably pro-American, and perhaps because, as I was saying, the fundamental truth is that people knew already what exactly happened, and that there is a degree of understanding of why the Americans covered it up.
That's an interesting, angle that you bring about the plane crash that killed Kaczynski's, as you say, President Kaczynski, and his wife, and many other politicians as well, because that did have, as you say, that resonated with the with Katyn at the time.
Absolutely. Well, it played into the sort of certain mentality that there is among certain Poles, and I do think they're in a minority, but a large minority, who are very inclined to believe in conspiracies and that the Russians once again were plotting against the country. It's a sensitive topic, and as this whole story about how the Americans covered up the real truth about the Katyn massacre shows, is that at the time, Poland was indeed a victim caught between two powers, when the moral imperative to tell the truth for the sake of the Poles just could not take precedence over the military imperative for the Americans of making sure that they won the war and kept Stalin on side back in 1943.
Indeed. Okay, well, amazing, isn't it, how all these details still come out even sort of 72 years after the events?
Interesting is if the Russians finally release the documents that they're sitting on, which it's believed really do contain new information that is yet not known, but so far, despite constant pressure from Poland, they haven't released all of their documents.
Yeah, likely, you think?
In the next few years, I don't know. I think they, in dribs and drabs, or when they need to improve relations with Warsaw. But there was a big step forward just before the plane crash in 2010, when Vladimir Putin, who was then Prime Minister, met with the Polish Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, in Katyn. And they released a lot of documents then, and that was seen as a big step forward. But then, since then, they haven't continued with the flow of releases.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens with that one. But for the time being, thanks very much, Gulliver. That's Monocle's man in Warsaw, Gulliver Cragg. You're listening to Midori House, where the time is 23 minutes past the hour. Now, last summer, two photographers were killed while reporting on the shelling of the Libyan city Misrata. Tim Hetherington and Chris Londros, both hugely experienced, had taken cover against a wall as shooting broke out between rebels and Gaddafi forces. A single mortar shell landed on the front line, killing them both. Hetherington had recently completed Restrepo, a documentary about the war in Afghanistan, with the journalist Sebastian Junger. Following Tim's death, Sebastian set up RISC, Risk, Reporters Instructed in Saving Colleagues, an organisation that trains freelancers on the front line in saving their colleagues' lives, the kind of help that could have saved Hetherington's himself. Well, Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield spoke with Sebastian Junger a little earlier today.
First of all, let's just talk about what it's like as a writer, journalist, photographer on the front line in these sorts of situations. Most of us have had some sort of training when we get there. Can that even prepare you, though?
I don't think it can prepare you that much. I mean, if you talk to soldiers, they go through incredibly extensive training, and they often say that, I mean, it helps, but psychologically it's very, very hard to adapt to combat until you're in combat. I think that's certainly true of journalists.
And when we look at the sort of things that, you know, some journalists are and photographers are lacking at the moment, do you think it's often sort of quite basic, simple, straightforward first aid that really could save lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are specific skills that are very, very good to have in combat, and those can be taught. The personal reactions to combat are very, very complex, and that's something you discover when you're in it. But these life-saving techniques are very medically very, very simple. I mean, you have to clear the air passageways and stop blood loss, and it's really kind, in a way, it's kind of basic mechanics. But you need some knowledge, some training, and some rudimentary medical gear to be able to do that. And freelance journalists, I don't think I know a single freelance journalist, and almost everyone on the front line is freelance. I don't think I know a single one who knows anything about battlefield medicine, and that was why I wanted to start this organization called RISC.
And is that part of the problem, that there are now more freelancers on the front line? Cause, I mean, when I think back to, you know, when I was first a foreign correspondent, I was sent by my newspaper on a hostile environment training course. I was taught that sort of battlefield first aid. I wasn't allowed out. I mean, frankly, they wouldn't be able to insure me to go to any sort of conflict zone unless I had that. Is that happening less and less, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, most of the journalists on a frontline situation, like in Libya and Misrata, almost all of those people were freelance. And some were working for big news organizations, but in the capacity of freelancers. It's much cheaper to buy a $500 photo from a freelancer than to provide a salary and pay for insurance and travel for a regular correspondent. It's way cheaper. And so it sort of makes sense. And in terms of the freelancers, they like it because it allows for an entry into the business that otherwise would feel quite restricted. And any inspired and enterprising 23-year-old can buy a couple of cameras and go to a hot zone and try to, you know, shoot the photograph that will be the start of their career. Anyone can do that. And it started, many careers have started that way, and it's a wonder, in a sense, it's a wonderfully democratic profession because of that.
Since you've started RISC, what's the reaction been amongst freelancers? I mean, have you had sort of numerous approaching you saying, yes, I want to do this?
We have a 100-person waiting list. We can take 25 people at a time, so we have quite a backlog of people who want to be trained. The reaction has just sort of anecdotally has been incredibly good. I mean, basically people are saying, you know, thank God this is happening, and a lot of people couldn't believe that this wasn't available before. Like, this is, sort of amazing that two generations of freelance reporters have come and gone without anyone bothering to get trained medically. It's happening now, so.
And just finally, I mean, do you think that there's a responsibility for editors, be that newspapers, magazines, or TV stations, to not take footage or reportage from journalists and photographers that haven't had some sort of training like this?
Well, what I don't want to be in a position of taking work away from freelancers in war zones, but I think there could be a way over the next years to have editors say to the freelancers that they work with regularly, look, you know, you have to get yourself trained. You already have a flak jacket, you have a helmet, and those things are new, by the way. 10 years ago, a lot of people didn't have them. Now you need medical training, and I think there's a way to do it without it being an absolute rule, but I think that kind of pressure will help a lot.
And that was Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, speaking with journalist Sebastian Junger on his new organisation, RISC, Reporters Instructed in Saving Colleagues. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobropa Jalavert, Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And in the next half hour of Midori House, we'll have news of the day's deals at the Berlin Air Show and be finding out how a Swiss federal agency is busy protecting the country's culture. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much. The US Vice President Joe Biden has spoken to the families of the victims at a memorial service in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, the site where United Airlines Flight 93 crashed after having been hijacked on September the 11th, 2001. It was one of several memorial ceremonies today to mark the 11th anniversary of the attacks which killed nearly 3,000 people. At least 23 workers have been burnt to death when a fire broke out in a Pakistani shoe factory in the eastern city of Lahore. People living in the neighbourhood rushed to help rescue workers trapped inside the factory. The expelled ANC Youth League president Julius Malema has today called for a national strike at all South African mines until the leadership of the National Union of Mine Workers steps down. The United Nations Secretary General has said today that the international mediator, Lakhdar Brahimi, will meet the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad during a visit to Syria. Ban Ki-moon said all sides were responsible for ending the violence in Syria. And the World Bank president has said the organisation stands ready to help debt-stricken Greece after meeting with the German Minister of Economic Cooperation. I'll have more news at the top of the hour. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One. To Berlin we go now, where the mention of aviation is a bit of a sore subject at present, following the embarrassing delay to the opening of the city's big new Brandenburg Airport that was meant to happen earlier this year and has now been put off, we think, until October 2013. But the delay hasn't put off the aviation sector's movers and shakers from assembling for the 2012 Berlin Air Show, one of the oldest on the calendar, to buy, sell and haggle over the latest planes and the products that are coming soon to an airline seat near you. Well, we're joined on the line now from Dan Tisdale, business editor at Flight Global. Hello, Dan.
Hello, hiya.
Now tell us, you've been at the air show. What's been the day's events so far?
Yeah, well, we've seen, obviously, they started air show flying today, and it's a lot of spectacular stuff. Airbus has made quite a splash here with this new A320 featuring what they call sharklets, which are really dramatic upturned wing tips that are supposed to cut fuel consumption by several percent, and they look really awesome. And we've seen, you know, the usual air show stuff here. A lot of fighter jets screaming around and military transports. Airbus again, big A400M that was rather a disappointment at the Farnborough Air Show because it couldn't fly, had a technical problem. Is up in the air here, so. And we have beautiful weather, so it's very hard to complain, really.
Well, that sounds good. We'll come to the this intriguing issue of the sharklets in a moment. But is this kind of Airbus's show, given that it's in their backyard?
Yeah, I think you could probably say that. They have a big presence here, which is understandable. Boeing hasn't particularly pushed the boat out. They have a very small presence in one of the exhibition halls. Airbus is kind of making the running here, I think.
Now, tell us about these sharklets. People who've ever flown on maybe Southwest Airlines or even Ryanair in Europe will know the Boeing versions, those sort of upturned bits at the end of the wings. Airbus's little wingtips have always been a bit smaller. They've always been a bit more modest. Are they just copying the Boeing ones?
No, I don't think so. The thing with wingtips is that the underlying physics is, and I wouldn't purport to understand it, but it's really, really complicated. And there are a lot of variations, a lot of different twists on this theme. And I think they can make a big difference. You know, the fine points can make a big difference. So, you know, Airbus believes it has sort of struck on a formula here that's both aerodynamically really efficient cuts some drag, it reduces turbulence out of the end of the wing, but also is structurally attractive in terms of not adding too much weight to the aircraft. So, you know, it's a formula that they think is going to be very appealing to customers. AirAsia is the launch customer. They're they actually call it JAWS because because of the potential to cut costs, so or take a bite out of costs, I guess. So you know, there's a bit of marketing hype, obviously, surrounding all this. But you know, indications are that they do the job they're meant to do.
Well, a marketing opportunity, I guess, as well, Dan, because it gives another surface on which airlines can stick maybe a logo or a website address or something.
Yeah, I think so. I think maybe we could expect to see advertising on the inside, yeah. You know, the cabin, the side visible from the cabin or something like that might be quite amusing.
And the launch customer choice of AirAsia is interesting in itself, because aren't they pretty much the world's biggest Airbus A320 customer?
Oh, I wouldn't like to say for sure, but yeah, they are certainly one of them. They are a very significant customer, growing dramatically. I think the thing to remember about AirAsia is that they are so significant in the region that the aerospace industry really, really needs to succeed in, because that is where the growth is coming from in terms of passenger traffic, in terms of number of flights, number of aircraft in service. And you know, that's where the money is really being made. And I think that's going to be the case for some years to come. Certainly not in Europe, a little bit, you know, more fragile in North America. But Asia, particularly Southeast Asia, is a very, very powerful market right now.
And is that growth area in Asia reflected in what you're seeing at the Berlin Air Show?
Well,
Because if it's, you know, only if it's only Europe, if Europe's such a terrible, yeah, terrible growth market for the airlines, it must be quite a depressing place to be at the moment.
Well, no, not at all. I think the thing that we have to remember is that the aerospace industry is a very, very global industry. The big players in terms of industry are here in Europe or in North America. That situation may change, but fundamentally that is where the weight of the industry is. You know, you could argue that the big air shows here, Berlin, obviously Paris, Farnborough, you know, may over time find themselves supplanted by shows that are over where the customers are, you know, rather than hold the traditional shows here in these markets. But for the moment, it's a buoyant industry. You know, you don't talk to anybody who's really struggling. Companies are doing amazingly well. Especially those who have a lot of exposure to the civil market. You know, airliner construction is strong. The order books at Boeing and Airbus are big. They're struggling on the business jet side, but and we're going to see a lot of cuts to defense spending. But civil aerospace is growing, and it's frankly picking up the slack that those other areas are letting off.
Indeed. Okay, a couple of final quick things before we have to go, Dan. First of all, anything you're looking forward to in the next couple of days?
Well, I'd like to myself get out and actually see some of the flying. There's a rather interesting aircraft here that's called Electra One Solar, which is a battery-powered ultralight aircraft made in Germany here that has actually got solar panels on the wings to give it some more range. And that's a pretty exciting development. It's not something I think that's going to change the shape of commercial aviation, but as a sort of sports aircraft and something for flight schools and maybe even for, you know, aerial observation, you know, it offers a lot of interesting potential. So there's some pretty exciting technologies here.
Okay, and finally, we said in the queue that aviation and Berlin airports don't make for particularly good bedfellows at the moment. Tell us, are a lot of people there talking about the failure of this big new airport to get off the ground, so to speak?
Yeah, well, I think the causes of the delay are many, I guess, and I have to confess I don't really understand that the details there too well. It is going to happen. I think Berlin's airport situation is, you know, been a complicated one, and the fact that it's going to take, you know, maybe an extra year to get it sorted out probably isn't too terribly significant. But it is kind of amusing that to try to get to the show here, the taxi drivers didn't even know where this was. So that I think says something about how high a mountain they have to climb to kind of get the word out that this new airport is actually as near to completion as maybe it is.
Oh dear! So not only do you need your pass, but you need a GPS to help you get there as well.
They don't have it on the GPS yet. That's the problem. So you need an English-speaking taxi driver, or you better speak German and get a map, I think.
Get a map. Good idea. Okay, thanks, Dan. That's all we've got time for. That's Dan Tisdale, business editor at Flight Global at the Berlin Air Show. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this to discover which university has taken top spot in the latest world rankings.
Marching in step with our defence-themed issue, Monocle Films reported to duty at Seer Precision. Designing groundbreaking camouflage, two Cooper Hewitt grads show how form and function can save lives.
We get a lot of people saying that they attribute their safety and sometimes their survival to multicam, specifically saying that in some instances we were caught in the open, we had no cover. We could see the enemy, we thought for sure they could see us, and somehow they didn't, and we were able to survive that engagement.
The Art of Getting Lost, a monocle.com.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. We explore the people and products, the buildings and businesses, the signs and cities that make life better. Each week we bring to life the relationship we have with the things that we live with.
Actually, one of my favorite objects is my motorcycle. I love going by motorcycle. I have this Royal Enfield, a classic English motorcycle from the 50s, but it's exactly as it was in the 50s. And I love the shape, the sound of the engine. I love really how it fits in my life.
We sit down with a cast of characters and chew through the issues at stake in the design world today, across manufacturing, craft, fashion, architecture, and graphics.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Minutes past the hour here on Midori House. Now, graduates and proud alumni, listen up. The UK's Cambridge has lost its place as the number one ranking university in the world to MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, beating not only last year's number one, but also pushing Harvard into third and Oxford University into fifth, behind University College London. The table has been drawn up by QS World University Rankings, who base positions on research quality, graduate employability, as well as how good the teaching is. Well, Martin Ince is the chair of the advisory board for QS World University Rankings, and I'm delighted to say joins us in the studio. Hello, Martin.
Good evening.
Now, tell us, how long did Cambridge have the top spot for? Just the year?
For 2 years. And before that, Harvard for several years in a row. I mean, Cambridge is a pretty great university by any standard, really. So they shouldn't be too depressed by this. And all these great institutions, Cambridge, Harvard, Oxford, etc., are pretty good. It's notable that it's something England is pretty good at, really, like sort of golf and tennis, you know. There are, as well as University College, you mentioned, there's Imperial, Oxford and Cambridge up there. So it's something that Britain's pretty good at, along with the United States.
Indeed. Well, before we get into the details of, you know, why somewhere like UCL might be ahead of Oxford, just tell us what tipped the scales in favour of MIT this year.
Partly they are... One of the things we measure is how international the university is. Most American universities are very poor at attracting international students, international academics, and MIT's pretty good at that.
Hmm. Why does that tend to be? Sorry to interrupt. Why does that tend to be generally?
In the United States?
Money or...?
It's, I think, principally because the United States is a big place. Most US universities are very oriented towards the home market, whereas Cambridge, Oxford, UCL, etc. would have far more foreign students. They bring in far more foreign academics as well. We regard that as a measure of how good a university is, because if it's a place where people are willing to cross continents or cross time zones to be there, that's probably a sign they're doing something right. We also survey, as well as academics, to see which are the good universities. We survey employers, because we know students want to go to a university that employers take seriously, and they show up very well in this survey. They also produce very highly rated research, which is very important, and especially in the science and technology area, the clue's in the name with MIT, with a university like the London School of Economics, more social science, that area, the research is much less visible, really, and you can't really see it in the same way as you can with science and engineering.
OK, so that's why what MIT is doing right. What about, certainly, before we get on to Europe, in the UK, a lot of UK universities, UCL, as we've already spoken about, Oxford, Cambridge, Imperial, any others?
Slightly below that category. There's a group of about 20 British universities, the Russell Group, which tend to, and you find all of them in this ranking, really. So the Liverpool, Manchester, Birmingham kind of group, not necessarily in the top 10, but certainly in the top 50. So, I mean, certainly, you know, Britain spends a lot of money on universities, and including now students spend a lot of money on it. And I think there's some evidence they're getting a quality product for their money.
That's interesting to compare that with continental Europe.
Well, in some continental European countries, you can go to a pretty reputable university for free, even in the modern era, which is, try telling this to Americans when you meet them, it's guaranteed to astonish them completely. And you see continental European universities here, but rather lower down, Switzerland, Germany, France. But they don't tend to compete in a world ranking with the big US and UK institutions.
Now, tell us also about the rise of Asian universities, Hong Kong, China, South Korea.
The tigers of East Asia, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Korea, have a big interest in university ranking. It's actually the epicentre of interest in this subject. I can guarantee it's gone big in the Korean newspapers today. And certainly these universities, these countries, I'm sorry, have all put a lot of money into building a world-class university system. The place it seems to work a bit less quickly is Taiwan. But certainly, partly because of Hong Kong and Singapore's historic connection to the British system, the fact they use a lot of English, they have highly rated universities, especially University of Hong Kong, National University of Singapore, that produce important research, produce very desirable students for employers. It's a little bit slower in Korea, but a top university, national university, is round about 30th in the rankings. But nonetheless, that is an astonishing figure, really, for a country that was, you know, it's had very rapid economic growth and it's wanted a highly educated workforce, which is what they've set out to build.
Well, it is indeed. And interesting, actually, how do you feel, and has your research shown that perhaps students, some of the best students from some of these, you know, big East Asian countries have stopped coming to either the US or to the UK to send their brightest brains there, and they're actually staying at home?
The number's certainly likely to come down in future years. There are plenty of universities all over Britain, the US, but also Australia, whose business model really is based on Chinese students coming in big numbers. And I think they're in danger of losing their shirts, these institutions, because as universities in China in particular build up their quality, they may not want to send all these people abroad. They may even want to attract students from other countries.
And tell us about the measures that you take into account, because obviously some of them, and you mentioned the ones in the UK, are only measured on research that they do and the amount of papers published, things like that.
We do this in two ways. The first is we seek opinion from academics around the world and from employers of graduates. And those two things together make up half the score you can get. And because these rankings are mainly intended for students, opinion of employers and professors obviously is very important. Big surveys of tens of thousands of people. Then we also measure the staff-student ratio. You know, have your university got enough teachers to teach its students? MIT, by the way, does very well in that. We measure how international they are for staff and students, as I said, to see if that's the place you want to be. And we also measure the amount of highly cited, which is the way research papers get noticed, research at universities publishing. And that really tells you the density of high quality brain power on the campus. Are you going to meet a top researcher in your next 20 yards walk? You know, have you got the people that are really generating the new ideas on campus? So it's, some rankings use dozens of measures, especially national ones. We use only sort of half a dozen pretty robust ones.
And amongst that, is there any space for how much fun somebody might have at university?
Well, we do that as well. We do a ranking of the world's leading student cities, which was recently won by Paris, despite which Boris Johnson still gave us a very nice interview about London coming second. So, yeah, we have a sort of slightly separate fun indicator that you can look at to see how many students, how international the place is, whether it's likely to have the resources to have a great time.
Mm. I guess it's not only, as you say, you know, Paris is a great city, you can't really avoid having a good time there, but even in small cities and small towns, you can still enjoy yourself. You might not end up with a first at the end of your 3 years there, but you might have a good time.
I'm always astonished at the students who can manage to get a first after having a pretty wild time as well. That's very impressive. Shows that people to look out for in the future.
Indeed. And just finally, Martin, what would you imagine Cambridge's reaction? Do you think they won't be too bothered, or they'll be keen to get their number one spot back?
Cambridge like this ranking. The previous vice-chancellor of the university liked it particularly because it does depend on the opinion of academics, which is a thing they respect. They'll be keen to get it back, but I don't think anyone's going to be fired or put out to grass because of it. They'll be irritated more than depressed, I think.
Fascinating. OK, I'm sure they will. Well, thank you very much
for coming in.
That's Martin Ince, Chair of the Advisory Board for the QS World University Rankings. You're listening to Midori House.
The Venice Architecture Biennale is a heady place to take the temperature of the industry and a good place to forecast its future. Monocle Films was there to do both.
As the industry flocked to Venice for the 13th Architecture Biennale, it was greeted by a storm of biblical proportions, which rolled into the lagoon out of nowhere. Even the greatest cynic pondered if this might be punishment for previous gaudy, expensive, ego-driven projects. But even these clouds had silver linings. As they tumbled away, they revealed a Venice that looked better than ever.
Architecture on film. In the programmes menu on monocle.com.
And you're back with the best educated show in town, Midori House, here on Monocle 24. Now, their industry boasts some of the highest tech processes in the world. And in business, their main cities are resisting the European malaise. But when it comes to culture, Switzerland is fiercely protective of its tradition. So much so that the Swiss Office of Culture has drawn up a list of living traditions to be defended and promoted. They include cherry growing, cow fighting, and cegete, figures in scary wood masks that line carnival routes. But to what extent does this list protect the Swiss culture rather than maintain the nation's sometime dusty image? Well, joining us on the line is Ellen Hertz, professor at the Institute of Ethnology at the University of Neuchâtel. Hello, professor.
Hi.
Now, I've almost certainly mispronounced cegete. Have I or have I not?
Not too much.
Okay. Now, tell us what happens in cegete. It's part of a carnival process?
Yes, it's... the particular masks that are called cegete are practiced in one valley in the Wallis canton, but there are masks in other areas too. And the masks are made of fibers and wood, and they're grotesque. They're exaggerated and grotesque, and the people who wear them wear large, like U.S. football player shoulder pads, so they're huge and large. And they walk down the street, and then at night there's a second part where they kind of chase after people and scare them. It's festive, it's carnivalesque, but it's scary when you're there.
Okay, well, it sounds fascinating. I must make the journey to see it. But just tell us, how much was the risk of these traditions being under in terms of just disappearing?
Well, this particular tradition is actually quite active, but you know, as you must know, Switzerland's been busy protecting its traditions for over 100 years. Switzerland's been living on tourism for over 200 years. UNESCO has now put its nose in this, and there's a convention, but Switzerland has been marketing masks and making them things that people come to see for these particular masks for almost a century.
In that case, what prompted this list to be drawn up by the Swiss cultural authorities?
Well, it's part of any country that signs the UNESCO Convention for the Safeguarding of Intangible Cultural Heritage, which is a new UNESCO convention. It was drafted in 2003, is obliged to make a list of its cultural heritage. And each country goes about it in a different way. And Switzerland is an extremely localized, decentralized political system, as you may know. So it produced a lot of traditions because the federal government sort of contracted this out to the cantonal governments, who indeed went down to the local governments. So many local associations and groups that have been busy doing traditional dance or lace making or any number of things got active.
I'm fascinated to see a slightly more sort of arcane and abstract tradition, and that's the one of Swiss graphic design, world-leading and world-beating in itself, but I'm not sure whether it's something that needs to be preserved and defended, or does it?
Well, I have to say none of the traditions in Switzerland need to be preserved and defended in the way that some of the traditions that this convention was designed to protect need to be. I mean, this convention has in mind the archetypical country that should sign this is a country like Brazil or someplace where there's indigenous populations that are menaced by enormous globalization processes or natural resource extraction and who are genuinely threatened. Switzerland, as I say, has been taking care of its traditional culture and mainly rural culture, making it into a tourist commodity for a long time. I'm not worried about any of these traditions. What's interesting is to see how they evolve and to see that there's a kind of back and forth between urban culture and rural culture in the evolution of some of these practices.
Okay, well, tell us, we mentioned in the queue cow fighting. I must say, I've been to Switzerland many times, but this one's new on me.
Oh, you haven't been up high enough.
only to Zermatt.
Yes. Well, it's because it's a particular time of the year, and it's a particular kind of cow, and it's a particular investment in the relation between owners and their cows, as is often the case with cow contests, and this is not unique to Switzerland. But these particular very, very heavy-set black cows, who are considered to be extremely intelligent, make for this spectacle. You don't do it with just any cow, and you only do it in a certain valley. So for Switzerland, this list has a lot to do with marking the differences between the different regions in Switzerland, which, as in England, are quite important, quite invested culturally. Not much more so than in some place like France or the United States, where we've kind of, I'm originally American, where the United States has kind of gotten rid of all local distinctions, except for perhaps the Deep South.
Well, interesting, indeed, and I would hate to get rid of the tradition of the cow fighting. I wonder if these cows are so intelligent, whether they actually know what they're doing and how important they are in preserving Swiss culture.
I'm sure they do.
I'm sure they do, too. What about gastronomy? That must be something worth safeguarding.
There's a number of, well, as you may know, the convention doesn't allow you to actually act upon food as such, but the art of doing certain kinds of food. So there's cheese making techniques, you know, of cheese making in the mountains, which is a kind of traditional technique. There's, what are they called, chestnuts, the cultivation of chestnuts. There's certain kind of festive occasions like it's called the Benichon, it's like Thanksgiving in the United States. So as long as they're associated with a social practice, food is on the list. But to avoid too much commercialization and the fact that people might use this for labeling processes, food as such can't be on the list.
And just finally, Professor Hertz, this must have prompted some interesting discussions at the University of Neuchâtel there. Maybe some people discussing possible omissions.
I'm directing a large research project on precisely the question of what gets in, what gets out, and it's very interesting to look at the website of this list because there's a huge emphasis, of course, on rural culture. You may know that 4% at most of the Swiss population is active in agriculture, so it gives a certain vision of Switzerland which doesn't correspond to its actual social economic structure, but corresponds to a kind of nostalgia about what makes Switzerland different from other places or certain images about a pre-industrial paradise. So we're studying what kind of narratives are being created through this list. Although I have to say that the Federal Office for Culture has been extremely careful and quite savvy. And there's a number of urban traditions also on the list. And there's even a rendezvous of motorcycle fans.
That's great. Professor Hertz, thank you very much. That's all from Midori House. Goodbye.